Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
In 1977, a young female hitchhiker catches a ride from a man who offers to bring her home. Within an hour, the man will murder her and leave her body to be found by a group of blackberry pickers a few days later. She has no identification on her. It's not long before they pinpoint him as the murderer, but he doesn't know her name. Investigators spend years trying to identify her, eventually giving her the name Precious Jane Doe in the hopes that it will help people remember her. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Heather Morris.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, as you are very well aware, I spend a lot of time researching for every episode.
Yes. Many hours.
So many hours of me in my office with my dog.
Yeah. I mean, and your research doesn't just stay with computer searches. Sometimes you're watching full movies, you're reading full books. Like, there's a lot of time involved.
There is. And one of my favorite things about research, obviously, is finding information that I can present in our podcast, of course. But I also find myself going into some, like, research. I call them my research rabbit holes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's my favorite part of research because, like, sometimes, like, I just end up in a completely different direction and it's stuff that's unrelated to, like...
I've seen some of those articles and things.
Yeah,
like the girl that was chased by the deer.
There was a girl who was chased by a deer and I came across it. It was in the same newspaper that I was researching for something else. And it was, like, this woman who was just trying to go to work and...
was attacked and fought off
a deer. Yeah.
So those are probably a fun little relief from the heavy stuff you are researching.
It is.
Like, I mean, it wasn't fun for her that day.
No.
And it wasn't, like, lighthearted that day. But she lived and she was fine and everything was good. So
I bet she had a story to tell. I mean, yeah. I also, like, there was, like, an interesting one about, like, some birds that had been, like, kidnapped from bird napped from a zoo. And
why?
No one knows.
Oh, okay.
They weren't, like, particularly valuable birds. And then there was, like, also one where I found out, like, at some point they were, like, feeding, like, concrete dust to cows.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
They thought it made them, like, bigger and the meat taste better.
Because concrete is big and tasty?
I have no idea. So, yeah, so I end up, like, in these, like, random directions. And I have to say, for this episode, I did end up in a few different directions that were less amusing. It's kind of like how this case, like, kind of connects outward to, like, some other things. We're covering a story from the Pacific Northwest today, and maybe that's par for the course for the Pacific Northwest, that some of your stuff is a little dark. I mean, I love our fans from that area. My nephew and his family live there, but frankly, I have some concerns, Pacific Northwest fans, about your area.
So, I mean, we also kind of feel this way about Long Island at this point.
Yes.
Is this worse?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What about the Texas killing fields? Like, that's pretty bad, too. There are pockets.
There are pockets. Yeah. At some point, I actually wanted to write an essay collection about, like, the kind of intersection of bad things that happen in the same places, which is a little weird. Maybe I will at some point, but yeah. I tried so hard to figure out how to include these things in our episode. But I think it, like, besides this conversation, would kind of take away from it. So I'm going to post, like, little tidbits that I found out on our social media page when we
are covering this Facebook episode. And Instagram, they'll be able to see some of these little, like, things you found when you fell down that rabbit hole.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I was like, I'm going to, like, figure out how to get this in here. And it's not possible. But it is interesting and has nothing directly to do with this case. Just sort of weird intersections. But let's get started with our story for today. By all accounts, August 9th, 1977, near Everett, Washington, was hot. Hot enough that when an older Chevy Nova pulled up beside a young female hitchhiker, it probably felt like a blessing to stop walking. It was around 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and she'd been walking south on the Bothell-Everett Highway on the east side of Silver Lake when the car pulled over. Inside was a young man. He offered her a ride, and she told him she needed to get to the south side of the lake so she could get home to the trailer she lived in with two men. The man agreed, so she got into his car. He asked her if she would like to have some beer, so they drove to Midland Grocery Store on 4th Avenue West and bought a six-pack of Bud Light. They took that with them and parked in a wooded area that was sort of behind Mariner High School. The woman drank part of her beer and had a cigarette. The man would later say he asked her to take off her top, and she did, and that he touched her chest, but when he asked her for sex, she refused. Again, this is from his perspective. Faced with this rejection, the man asked her if she would like a peacock feather.
A peacock feather?
A peacock feather.
Like as a gift?
Presumably.
Okay. First off, I part of me is like, oh, good Lord, she got in a car with this guy and now she's drinking in the woods with him. But then also it's the 70s and I feel like this kind of thing would have been more normal. Like now in retrospect, we're like, no, don't do it. Don't accept the ride. Don't accept the beer. Don't accept the peacock feather. But I think for then it would have been, I think there was like more of a feeling of safety. Like you could do these things without anything happening.
Yeah. I mean, so a lot of how we have framed our lives and like, you know, have made decisions currently in our contemporary area about safety and what is safe is like also built off of like this history of things. So in the 70s and 60s, particularly, like women were hitchhiking quite frequently.
Right.
Like, and also men. But like, this was, you know, a regular occurrence, and now...
But I have a feeling, like, stories like this...
Yes.
...are what changed us from having the freedom to do those things.
Exactly.
So did she take the peacock feather?
She says yes.
Okay.
To the peacock feather. I'm not sure what else you would say in that situation when someone's like, do you want a peacock feather?
Honestly, I kind of want a peacock feather.
No, you don't.
Well, not his peacock feather, but, like...
In general.
In general. If one fell out of a peacock. Wait, no?
I don't know.
Would you not want the feather?
Aren't there like, isn't there like avian flu or something? I don't even know.
Put it in the freezer.
Okay, got it.
Feathers in the freezer, safe.
Safe, okay. So she takes the peacock feather. He gets out of the car. He grabs the peacock feather from a collection of peacock feathers in the trunk. He also grabs a bungee cord and walked around to the passenger side of the car where he handed her the feather. That's when he wrapped the bungee cord around her neck and used it to pull her from the vehicle. He would later say that the bungee cord broke as he dragged her, so he had to go back to the car and get another one. He also said that as he dragged her into some brush, her body started to convulse, and this is likely due, I'm guessing, to the lack of oxygen.
So he's admitting to, like, he says he did all these things.
Yes, we know a lot about this case.
That went really quickly.
The escalation there?
Yeah. Yeah.
The man... then went back to his vehicle and grabbed a .22 caliber Marlin rifle from his trunk and walked back to the woman who was laying on the ground, and he shot her 7 times. After the man collected evidence from the scene, including some of the beer bottles and whatever else he could find, then he left her there and drove away. Later, angered about what had just happened, apparently he shot at his own vehicle.
So this is all really quick.
Yeah, in total they had spent about an hour together.
Okay.
4 days later, on August 13th.
So the anger is just over the sex thing.
The anger, I think, is anger at the whole situation as a whole.
Okay. So he did not intend to kill her? It seems like he was kind of prepared.
It's really unclear. I mean, he'll talk about it later.
He will? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So 4 days later, on August 13th, police were called about a man waving a rifle around in a park in Gold Bar, Washington. Gold Bar, for reference, is about 30 miles away from Everett. When police arrived, though, the man had already left. Soon after, they spotted a car driving erratically on US 2, which connects Gold Bar to Everett. They pulled him over, and when they did, they could smell pot and were able to see two roach clips in the ashtray. When they searched his car, they found three baggies of weed and his .22 caliber Marlin rifle. His car was impounded and he was arrested.
Are roach clips a thing anymore? Just brought back memories of people wearing them in their hair.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever remember that?
No. Is this a Canadian thing?
Oh. I'm sure it's not a Canadian thing, but I remember people wearing like feathered roach clips in their hair.
I have no memories of this.
Okay. Carry on.
Maybe it's because you're older.
I am so much older. How old did you just turn?
We're not discussing that. Okay. So up until this point, the woman's body has not been found. After all, he had left her in a pretty out-of-the-way area. But on August 14th, the day after the man's arrest in Gold Bar, that changed. Around 1 in the afternoon, some people picking blackberries stumbled across her body. Police reported to the scene, and they found the woman who had been shot to death. She was laying face down with her arms by her side. She was fully clothed, still wearing her pastel-striped tank top, cut-off jean shorts, and men's sneakers. On her, there was a partial pack of Marlboro cigarettes, and in her pocket was 17 cents. She had no identification, and her features were obscured because she had been shot in the head. Though there were no shell casings at the scene, there are reports they did find two beer bottles. At the Snohomish County Coroner's Office, she was given the case number 77-8-621 as they attempted to identify her. They really had little to go on. They knew she was a taller woman, around 5'10", that she was white, that she had shortish brownish hair. They thought she might be between the ages of 20 to 30, and her teeth had, what they had determined at the time, minimal restoration and appeared in good condition. That led them to believe that she lived somewhere with good water quality and access to dental care. They were, though, unable to obtain fingerprints from her due to the condition of her body. Later, they would remove her hands and send them to the FBI in the hopes that they would be able to use more advanced techniques to get fingerprints.
Does that normally happen? I just imagine that the fingerprinting would be done with the entire body. This is something I've never thought of before.
That they would just take her hands. Yeah, so at the time, they would have needed more advanced.
We don't do this still, do we?
I'm not sure. I'm going to look into that.
Okay.
While the young woman was being brought to and examined at Snohomish County Coroner's Office, the man, who I'm now going to call D, was in jail. At this point, he isn't a suspect in the woman's murder, which is why it's not surprising that on August 15th, the day after she was found, Dee was let out of jail under the understanding that he would appear in court later for those charges for the marijuana possession.
Mm-hmm.
When he left, he headed to his friend Robert's house and told him how he had murdered someone. As he recounted what happened that afternoon, Dee told Robert they deserved it. I can't imagine what it would be like to have a friend confess something like this to me, and I suspect Robert didn't quite know what to do either. It took him 4 days, but he did go to the sheriff's office and related to them what Dee had told him.
I think when you're dealing with someone who said that they just murdered somebody because they deserved it, you'd have hesitations about, like, going and turning that person in just for your own safety.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think...
So, like, Robert knew it was the right thing to do, but...
It's scary.
Probably scared.
So scary. Yeah. This was the lead that Sheriff needed, so they got a warrant and went to Dee's mom's house in Linwood. He'd been staying with her in Linwood, which is north of Everett, and sleeping on her couch. The search of the house yielded some clues. They collected pills, drug paraphernalia, and they also had enough information that they knew to collect the bottles looking for evidence there. So they're collecting beer bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And they also collected peacock feathers. On the inventory page from their search, it says more peacock feathers and unknown amount at this time. When they counted later, they found that there were 8 that they collected from the living room and 7 from the garage.
I'm so curious about why this guy has like got a peacock feather obsession. Also, just to be clear, was there a peacock feather with the body?
Not sure.
We're not sure. Okay, so it's not something that the police would see and be like connecting.
Yeah, I don't know, actually.
Okay.
Dee, though, and the car he had been driving were not at this residence. They ended up tracking down the Chevy Nova, where it was parked at his brother's house. Written on the passenger side window, it said, "Ass, gas, or grass, hardly anyone rides for free.
Okay, so it's really weird that this was this thing then, because I just saw somebody on Facebook Marketplace selling those bumper stickers right now.
Really?
Yes. There was a whole bunch of like kind of off-the-wall bumper stickers, and that was one of them. And it actually took me a minute to like process what that meant, and then I was like, oh, ew.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
I guess that phrase...
It's been around.
Did not stay in the 70s.
It didn't. Unfortunately, it's still here now.
So next time I see one on someone's car around town.
Mm-hmm.
When they search the vehicle, though, they end up finding some more evidence. They bag a single long brown hair that was found among the peacock feathers that were still in the trunk. They also found bullet slugs as well. Later, those would be matched to the ones found in the woman's body. They also checked the car for fingerprints. They found about 75 usable fingerprints on the car and the beer bottles they collected from the house, but none of them were matched to the victim. Despite being able to collect all of this evidence, they were still missing Dee. The sheriff decided that they would arrest him on August 22nd when he was scheduled to appear for his pre-sentencing interview in district court on the marijuana charges he was facing from that traffic stop, but he never showed up. Dee was a fugitive for over a year before he was arrested on January 18, 1979, in Port Orchard, Washington, on the warrant for possession of a controlled substance. The Port Orchard police called the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office, and when they arrived, they had to transport Dee back via the Kingston Ferry to Edmonds. It's on the ferry that he confessed to a Snohomish detective that he had murdered the young woman. His confession was completed later and taped. During the confession, he made clear that he did not know the young woman's name. Now, Dee was given a public defender by the name of Mark Mestel, and despite the confession, entered a plea of not guilty. His trial was set for June, but just before opening statements, I mean like just before the opening statements were about to begin, he fired his lawyer. Instead, friends and family had retained a lawyer named Paul Akison to take over the case. Akison successfully lobbied for the trial to be delayed until September while he reviewed the case. Now, Akison was up against some pretty tough odds in defending his client, particularly because he had made a confession. So he tried to get this confession thrown out by saying that a combination of factors, including Dee's mental state, the confining quarters of the ferry, and Dee's dependence on his mother, who he believed was being threatened by the sheriff's office, led him to give these statements involuntarily. Now, this request was denied. Ultimately, after the closing arguments in the trial, it took the jury just 7 hours to convict Dee of first-degree murder. The primary reasons they came to this conclusions were really the taped confession and also the testimony of his friend, Robert.
Right. It's hard to take something back that you've now said twice.
Yes. So we've got the confession to the friend. We've got the confession to the police. Right.
And the friend wasn't, like, trapping him on a ferry.
No.
So no. It's...
Yeah. So those were really pivotal points in this case. So at the age of 22, Dee was sentenced to 26 years in prison and would not be eligible for parole until March 1997. At the time, the case against Dee was considered unusual because they still didn't know the identity of the woman. They did an early sketch of her using a kit. We talked about this kind of kit in our last episode about Martha Stiver and Sandra Stiver, but basically it provided different versions of various facial features that could be mixed and matched until you got an approximation of the person. So we have one for her as well.
Did that one turn out well?
You know, honestly, it was not too bad.
Okay, really. So the kit didn't fail this time?
I mean, it's not great, but it's not the worst.
Okay.
So this, along with news coverage of Dee's trial, did produce some leads and suggestions, but none of those panned out, of course. Eventually, this woman's remains were buried, except for her skull. Apparently, this was common practice for the Snohomish County Medical Examiner's Office at the time. There were limited storage spaces in their offices, and it was believed that her skull would yield the most clues, so that's why they kept it out.
I'm having a hard time with the things that happened to this woman after.
Yeah, that essentially they're like parting her out.
Right. The hands and now the skull. Like, it's one thing. We know the bad guy's going to do bad things to her, but we expect her remains to be treated more respectfully.
Yes.
By authorities. I mean,
so authorities now, they do actually, they have made clear that now this is not the processes they
I can't imagine use. It happening now. Like, this would outrage people.
Yeah, so they make clear this is not the processes they use contemporarily, but in the 1970s, this was kind of more standard for them. And with this, they're still searching for her, but there's not much movement on her case for many years. In October 1988, Dr. Gary Bell, a forensic odontologist, does take a look at her skull, particularly examining her teeth. He found that despite prior assessments of her teeth having minimal work done on them, that her two front teeth had actually undergone quite a bit of work. He noted that they had at some point been fractured due to an unknown trauma and had been repaired. Dr. Bell also readjusted her age. Again, previously they thought that the woman was between 20 and 30, but he felt like she was more between 17 and 24. That seems like a small adjustment, but it changes the investigative presumption, and so it opened them up to pursuing leads for missing teenagers. And then in 1992, her information was entered into the NCIC database.
So what does NCIC stand for?
NCIC is the National Crime Information Center. It was started in 1967 as a way to track information about crimes across state, federal, local, tribal investigative agencies. This database is meant to assist with all sorts of different crimes, but it did include missing and unidentified persons.
Does it still exist now?
Yes.
Okay.
Around this time, Detective John Hines did a clay model of this Jane Doe in order to help identify her. With access to her skull, he used its shape and size to build a plaster cast and use that for her facial reconstruction. Now, I think everyone agrees now, once they see this model, and I'll definitely share this one on social media, that it is unsettling in its appearance. And Detective Hines, I think, agrees as well in retrospect, but it did provide one of the first updates for a visual interpretation of her since that sketch had been done in the 1970s.
Now, to be clear, did he do this himself or did he have an artist do it?
He did it.
Okay.
Despite this update, there again are no solid leads.
We'll be back in a moment.
Around 2007 or 2008, this case ends up on the desk of James Scharf. He's working the cold case unit and he's ready to look at it with new eyes. He's learned about advances with DNA and thinks that it's possible that they could get some leads using this. Now, at the time, DNA analysis was mostly confined to one-to-one comparisons, meaning that if they're able to get her DNA, they can compare it to another sample to see if they were matches. Detective Scharf asks for her body to be exhumed because the best place to get the DNA at the time was from her longer bones of the body. Eventually, this request was granted and she was exhumed on April 1st, 2008. Soon after, Dr. Catherine Taylor, who is the Washington State forensic anthropologist, examines her remains and made an age adjustment again. Dr. Taylor thought it was likely she was between the ages of 15 to 24, and most likely falling between the ages of 16 to 19. Dr. Bell, the forensic odontologist who had looked at her in 1988 and examined her teeth again, and his new analysis is that she was 16 to 22.
Now, she was really tall, wasn't she?
Yes, like 5'10".
I wonder if that contributed to them thinking she was older.
It's possible. I mean, but we do know that kind of these age ranges.
Right. They're always kind of loose, right?
Yeah. It's like, it's science. But it's kind of an inexact science, right?
Right. I think you've told me of ones that are like, they're between like 19 and 40.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. So around this time, they also contacted Detective Hines, who had done that clay model of her. It's unclear if he actually still had her skull from his 1992 rendering, or if they mean that he still had the plaster cast. I know that I just said Dr. Bell looked at her teeth again, which would indicate that they had her skull. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that examination took place before or after. And really, as many times as I've heard accounts of evidence of skeletal remains being misplaced, I've learned that I shouldn't assume anything here.
Right. So. And was it a separate plaster cast or was it clay put directly on her skull?
It was separate.
A separate. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was two items.
So I'm not sure if
he still had both.
Yeah. It's unclear if he was, like, in possession of her actual skull or the, like, model of her skull. But
seems weird.
In any case, they contact him again, and he had actually gone through and done sketches and models in other cases around the country after he retired. So he did a new sketch of her. In June of 2008, they removed her left femur. So it's more.
More.
Yeah. And sent it to the University of North Texas to do DNA sequencing for her. They were only able to get a partial DNA sequence from this, but this DNA information, along with her updated age ranges and the new sketches, were uploaded to CODIS and then later to the profile on the brand new National Center for Missing and Unidentified Persons Systems database.
For some reason, I'm not as disturbed by the femur as I am, but the hands just kind of struck me.
Yeah. Well, this information did lead them to discovering dozens of potential matches for her. These did have to be compared individually by looking at the DNA match or the dental records, and none of those were successful. Detective Scharf tried another method. He made a short video about her that he shared with other agencies and also placed a link to this video in his email signature. He also started referring to her as Precious Doe as a way to remember her and as a way to call attention to her case. Why he selected Precious Doe? Well, okay, one of his earlier statements is questionable, I think, from the difference of what people said about 10 to 15 years ago versus today. So I'll just use his later statement, which was, "It struck my heart. I knew there's got to be people out there who loved her. She's precious to me, just like she must have been precious to them. So that's why I named her Precious Jane Doe."
What did he used to say?
It was kind of like, I don't want to necessarily misquote him, but it was like along the lines of like, she was precious to him basically because she had like done the right thing and turned down this guy for sex.
Oh, so if somebody like froze in the moment, they're not precious?
Yeah, so like that's where I'm like,
ew. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's go with that.
We're going with this one.
With the new one. Yes. Yeah. Ew.
Ew. Yeah, that's definitely like of the time. Not to excuse it, but.
Ugh. Yeah, it's of the time.
Yeah. It's definitely things that you and I had heard probably a lot, like,
oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah, but okay.
Yeah. In 2015, with little progress in identifying her, Detective Scharf tried something again unusual. He went and found the woman's killer, D. Now D, we're going back to his story a little bit to give some context to how this ends up happening. Dee had been up for parole in 1997, but wasn't granted it. Around 1999, he started writing statements about the murder, claiming that he'd had some repressed memories about this time. He said that he had been contemplating why he had been so angry when the woman rejected him, and had recently remembered it was because she had threatened him by saying that her two boyfriends, presumably the men that she lived with, would harm him for propositioning her. In a letter to the judge, he wrote, "Before the remembrance of this pertinent detail, I had been telling the board, and also when I confessed that I thought I killed her because she rejected my advances towards her. I had always had a deep feeling that that was not the real reason."
So originally he said it's because she rejected him, but now he's saying it's because she threatened him. But like, and I'm not to say like that isn't the way he's remembering it now, because like we've talked about before, like memories of things can change. Memories of situations can change. And I feel like if she truly would have said that, he would have remembered it at the moment.
Right. And again, he's the living member of this interaction. So he gets to say whatever he wants to.
Right. He's like the privileged one in what happened, right? Like,
yeah. And, you know, this doesn't go over well with the parole board. Like, because really the parole boards are looking for you to take accountability for your actions and own up to what happened. And that's not something he was doing here. He was kind of, well, he was victim blaming.
Like, right.
It's her fault because she threatened me. In his remaining time in prison, though, Dee did begin to realize the harm he had done to someone else. He was eventually released in 2005, and I'm not sure how he initially felt when Detective Scharf arrived on his doorstep, but he was willing to help under the condition that they wouldn't actually talk about the murder itself. Dee would later tell reporters, "The girl's story is what we're after. I see the detectives going out of their way to find her identity. When these guys asked, I told them I'd do whatever I could. I can no longer help her, but I can help those who are looking for her. Some things we have to do."
So he's basically separating the girl from the murder so that he can help identify her? Is that what he's like trying to ultimately do here?
He ultimately does not want to revisit really
what he did.
But he does realize that he's a key player and might be able to offer something that could help. So though he does try to help, again, they had spent about an hour together before he murdered her. He said, "I've been trying to remember what she looked like. It's not something I try to forget. I wish I could. As the years go by, the details fog up."
On one hand, I'm like, okay, well, try to think of the face of somebody you saw one time. Like, what are we talking now? 30?
Yeah, so.
Something years ago.
Over, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You spend 1 hour seeing this person and then that's it. That's going to be hard. Maybe. Then the other part of me is like, but you murdered her, so maybe you should probably commit what she looks like to your memory. But it is kind of, I don't know how to say this without sounding sympathetic. I do not mean sympathy here. But I'm guessing that you feel some sort of stress in your body when you kill a person. And stress sometimes makes it harder to remember details too. But I don't know.
Like, yeah, or stress can do the opposite, right?
Right. Yeah, or stress can do the opposite. It can commit it even more to memory. But I'm hoping he feels some sort of stress, but I don't know if that's a thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wish he could have remembered more about her. He is the one who took her life. It is, you know, noteworthy that he is actively helping try to identify her, which is not actually something that we've included in any of our episodes before, like a killer actually.
Like he's got like a tiny bit of a moral compass.
Not even. But like, you know, it's just like that, you know, this is the first moment I've been actually able to say like, oh, like actively trying to help figure this out, right? He is not able to remember too much about her, but he is able to correct some details in their versions of her in their sketches. So in 2016, forensic sketch artist Natalie Murray was able to do a new sketch based on this information. That brings us to 2017. Detective Scharf reaches out to Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick, one of the founders of the DNA Doe Project. This was before some pretty landmark cases in investigative genetic genealogy, which were the identification of the Golden State Killer in 2020, and also the identification of Marcia King, which was done by the DNA Doe Project, who had previously been known as the Buckskin Girl. We did an episode about her case. Dr. Fitzpatrick was hoping that a successful attempt in identifying Precious Jane Doe would be pivotal in getting other agencies to understand the ways in which this could be used in their Doe cases. But there were some key problems in the Precious Jane Doe case. At some point, her bones were described as being cooked down in order to extract DNA from them, likely during the attempt that got the partial DNA profile from her.
I don't know what that means.
Cooked down.
Do they have to cook it to get the DNA?
Yeah.
So much has happened to this poor girl.
I know.
It's going to lead to something good, right? Though, like, eventually, are we going to find out who she is?
Yes.
Okay.
Also, when this exhumation of her body happened in 2008, her grave had been notably watery, meaning that there had been water infiltration, which would have degraded the remains.
And why couldn't they use that partial DNA sample that they had before?
Right. So they had that sample from 2008. So in basic terms, the partial DNA sample from this 2008 was not the type of DNA sample used in family tree databases. So they needed to get the right type of sample in order to start searching for family members in those databases.
It's funny because when you said that before, I was thinking like, what are they going to compare it to? Because we didn't have like all the 23andMe and Ancestry and all that stuff then. So like when they first took that sample.
Yeah. So when they first took that sample, it was really like,
this would be such a small amount of people they can compare that DNA to compared to now.
Yeah. So back in 2008, when they took the DNA sample, it was really for the one-to-one comparison. So if they found DNA from a missing person and they could do a comparison there, or they found DNA from a potential relative, like a sibling or a parent, they could compare, like, but on a one-to-one basis, not right. On a bigger database.
Right, not finding maybe like her uncle or somebody that they can like connect her to.
Right. So they're hoping to go even bigger than they had before. So despite all of these challenges they were facing, Dr. Fitzpatrick was still hopeful. She said, "We have the technology to start approaching DNA samples that we couldn't look at the past because they were so degraded." So samples of her skull and teeth were sent to a lab in Virginia for DNA extraction. That was unsuccessful. So they moved on to her femur. Again, this was unsuccessful. Later that year, Detective Scharf would go on to connect with Dr. Barbara Ray Venter. Her name might be familiar as the woman who worked on the Golden State Killer case for those who followed that news. So she, you know, this is predating that big news announcement, but she was able to get Detective Scharf in touch with Dr. Ed Green of the University of California, Santa Cruz. His work was in paleogenomics, and he'd been successful in extracting DNA from older and more degraded samples. When Dr. Green looked at all the work that had been done previously on this case, he determined that their best course of action was try to extract DNA from rootless hair, which is a development I don't think most people are aware of because back in the day, hair samples would have needed the root for this process. Thankfully, a sample of her hair had been kept and they were sent a small sample, roughly the diameter of a pencil. And most of 2018 was spent trying to obtain a usable DNA sample for her. And once they were finally able to get one, though, it was turned back over to Dr. Ray Ventner and Firebird Forensics. Now, sometimes this process goes really quickly. Marcia King, who I mentioned earlier, her case was one that took a matter of hours to solve using investigative genetic genealogy, right? For Precious Jane Doe, though, this took 2 years and thousands of hours because she only had distant relatives in the database. Researchers ended up creating dozens of family trees trying to figure out who she might be. Eventually, in June 2020, they narrowed it down to who they thought her parents might be, but their three children were accounted for in all of the records. It wasn't until they spotted a single reference to an Elizabeth Marie Elder on genealogy.com alongside three brothers that they were able to determine that there was likely another child for this family. Through their further research, investigators were able to find Precious Jane Doe's potential younger half-sister on her mom's side. This half-sister was able to confirm that her mother did have a daughter named Elizabeth, who her mother had to give up for adoption when Elizabeth was young.
So that probably complicated things a lot, too, that she was
put
up for adoption.
Anytime there are adoptions in cases like this, it's much harder. So their family is a bit complicated, but Elizabeth has an older half-brother, as well as three full brothers.
Okay.
So this older half-brother, he had also been given up for adoption before Elizabeth was even born. He'd done a DNA kit for Ancestry.com, so he was instructed to upload this to GEDmatch, where researchers could compare his kit to Precious Jane Doe. This led to a match. Precious Jane Doe had been born Elizabeth Marie Elder in 1959 in Hood River, Oregon.
So that puts her at 18 years old?
17. Now, Elizabeth's birth family was able to share some details about her. Her parents had four children together, three boys and then Elizabeth. Her father had retained custody of the three boys. But in 1970, her father, his new wife, and all three boys died in a car accident.
So she was living full-time with her dad?
No, he did not want...
Was she she was already adopted out? So they kept some kids, but not other kids?
You know, this actually happened to my brother, who is adopted. His grandmother decided she wanted custody of a girl, but said she didn't want to raise a boy. And so the girl was raised in the family and he was sent out for adoption. So I'm not sure the circumstances here, but yeah, her father kept the three sons and she was put up for adoption.
And they're all older than her.
Yeah.
But then the boy that was put up for adoption is also older than her, but a different dad.
Yes.
Okay. The car accident thing is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
Even though he didn't want to keep her. I don't know. This is like...
There's a lot.
This is a lot.
A layers in here. Right. So Elizabeth had been adopted out around the age of two, and her mother asked her adoptive parents to keep her first and middle names. Later, her mother had hired a private investigator to find her, but was unsuccessful. Now, her older half-brother, who had reconnected with his mother before she passed away, did provide a list of potential last names for Elizabeth, but researchers were unable to find a match for her when they conducted their search. So they're using those as a guide to try to find out, you know, who adopted her. Eventually, they were able to get the Oregon Center for Health Statistics to release the name of her adoptive family. In June 2020, they got in touch with her adoptive father. Her mother had previously passed away. He said that in life, her name was Elizabeth Roberts, but that she had gone by the name Lisa. Lisa was a junior in high school attending Roseburg High School when she ran away from home on July 25th, 1977. Now, there were rumors among her birth family that she had run away because she'd found out she was adopted, but her dad was able to dispel those rumors. He said she knew this information long before this point in her life. He said that she ran away after a disagreement with him and his wife. She was reported missing immediately and was entered into the NCIC database. That was a file opened up for her, but for some reason this file was deleted the same day it was created.
That's really strange.
It's, yeah, so for some reason it was created, like...
But everything's stacked against this girl for them to find out, like, who she is.
Yes, so that's why she was never in any missing persons databases. They thought they had that covered. They thought that she had this file out there, but...
She didn't.
So that's why Lisa was never entered into any other databases, like the NamUs one, and you wouldn't have found her case listed anywhere. Her father did say that not long after she left, she did call home, and her parents begged for her to return, but she said she'd have to think about it. She did say she was in Everett, Washington, but refused to disclose more information about where she was staying. Her father said he would send her money, and he did. He wired her $500 to SeaFirst Bank in Everett. He learned later that she never picked it up. And Lisa had left home just 15 days before she was murdered.
I feel like this is yet another story that is like, we always go back to like, even if someone runs away, we need to keep tabs. And he did. The dad seems like he did everything right. He tried to keep in touch with her in a gentle way that like respected her on that. And he did try to get her some money. But like so much can happen to a kid just out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, she's young and... You know, her case is clearly a runaway case, right? And we talk all the time. Those runaway cases need to be taken seriously. And her life changed in an hour.
Right. And it doesn't seem, she wasn't targeted or anything. It just seems very random. Like he was just, he had the opportunity and he took it.
Yes. So she was there and just, and I always think about this with cases like this. She's just like trying to go about her day, like just trying to get home.
Right.
It's hot out. Someone offers her a ride. Right. Like, okay, we're doing this thing.
Right. And at the time, he probably didn't even know he was going to do this.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't.
So, like, it's not a predictable thing on either end on this one.
Yeah. As an aside, I had wondered about her teeth and kind of what might have happened. Yeah. So, apparently, they'd been broken in school not long before she ran away. She played the flute and had her flute up to her mouth when a boy hit the other end of it.
Oh, okay.
And the impact broke her teeth. And so those were repaired. And as for the man who murdered Lisa, her killer died of cancer on August 9th, 2015. It was the 38th anniversary of the day he killed Lisa.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, La Belle au Bois Dormant, read by Heather Morris. Heather is best known for her comedic breakout role as Brittany S. Pierce on Fox's hit series Glee. She is currently recurring as Judy in the CBS hit comedy So Help Me Todd and is executive producer and writer on the dark comedy podcast The Bystanders, available on all podcast platforms. Morris has appeared in numerous indie films, including the upcoming comedy Cora Bora, starring Meg Stalter and Manny Jacinto, and voiced the role of Katie the Mammoth in the multi-million-dollar franchise Ice Age, Continental Drift. Aside from a successful career as an actress, Heather is an incredibly established dancer who began her career with Beyoncé and currently travels the country teaching for a Heat dance convention.
La Belle au Bois Dormant. Unidentified woman discovered August 14, 1977, in Everett, Washington. Gifts. 1. An orange Chevy Nova, the means of transmutability. 2. A single bright peacock feather, the bearer of immortality. 3. A blue woven bungee cord, the measure of air. Spindle. There is no breath in this cockspur wasteland shot through with brambles. Deep in the briar, the sweet juice over pricked skin, I trace the arc of these bitter roots. Prince, if I knew contours inside the dark lobes of his heart, this moment would want for love. Awakening. In the forest of thorns, I sleep heavy under the humid sky. This, the birth of my own true light. How am I to hold it?
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.